Okay, I've got a question for you this morning. Where is the best place to experience God's presence? Thanks to Brooklyn Tom, you know, one of her ideal spots there. She's painted that for us, and if you want to see, you know, the live version, if you will, on your way out afterwards, you'll see that, and another one that's being hung up to see, you know. We sang this morning, you know, about God's outdoor cathedral, you know, strong God. This is God in his holy place, and it was a beautiful, majestic mountain. Could be in a house of worship. You know, but it could also be that, there are many good places to experience God. The Gospels tell us that Jesus often withdrew to quiet or lonely or desert places to pray. But I think a case can be made that the best place to experience God's presence is not in the most wonderful place or setting that we can think of, but in the worst. Reminded of a story, maybe fictitious, that I heard years ago about a taxi driver and a priest that both died and went to heaven. And they were welcomed at the pearly gates by, of course, St. Peter. And they were shown their places, and the taxi driver had quite a fancy mansion that he was being taken to, and the priest was being taken to quite a humble, small house. And the priest said, excuse me, I think you've got it mixed up. And Peter said, oh no, he said, you know, when you preached, most of the people slept. But when he drove, the taxi driver, most of the people prayed. Okay. Well, the people that we are going to meet in today's story, and I encourage you to turn to Genesis chapter 16. So the first book of the Bible, Genesis chapter 16. We are going to meet them, you know, in a great place to meet God. Let's call it that. Now, this is the third in the series, summer series on experiencing God. There is so much that we want to experience in life, right? Some people have a bucket list or a wish list, you know, and maybe it's riding on the new roller coaster at Playland. Anybody? No? Oh, no. Okay, some are thinking no, not at all. But experiencing God, his presence, his power, his comfort, his correction, his guidance is even better. So let's read Genesis chapter 16. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. But she had an Egyptian slave named Hagar. So she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my slave. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Abraham agreed to what Sarai said. So after Abraham had been living for Canaan 10 years, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian slave Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar, and she conceived. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. Then Sarai said to Abram, "You are responsible for the wrong I am suffering. I put my slave in your arms, and now that she knows she is pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." "Your slave is in your hands," Abraham said. "Do with her whatever you think best." Then Sarai mistreated Hagar, so she fled from her. The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was the spring that is beside the road to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from, and where are you going?" "I'm running away from my mistress Sarai," she answered. Then the angel of the Lord told her, "Go back to your mistress and submit to her." The angel added, "I will increase your descendants so much that they will be too numerous to count." The angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are now pregnant, and you will give birth to a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard of your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him, and he will live in hostility toward all his brothers." So she gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her, "You are the God who sees me. For she said, I have now seen the one who sees me. That is why the well was called Beer Lahai-Roi. It is still there between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abraham a son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son she had born. Abraham was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. Well, this chapter begins with Sarai experiencing something many people experience, not necessarily childlessness, but pain, emotional pain, a problem, a deep disappointment because life isn't going according to plan. Her problem is stated in simple, stark terms in the opening verse. Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children. And we might add, and time is running out, if it hasn't already. This is more than a deeply personal problem, though it is not less than that. But God himself had clearly and repeatedly promised on oath, back and already in chapter 15, that they would have a son and so many descendants that they couldn't even count them all. So what do you do when God seems inactive and time is running out? Maybe you're wishing for a marriage partner. Maybe an application that determines your future and it's just no response. Maybe the family members that you have been praying for and you're thinking, I don't know how much time I have left. Well, this story shows us how to work on plan B. You know, Sarai proposed a solution and Abraham accepted it. A proposal that often shocks Western readers, but culturally it was standard practice. It was even written into contracts that they have found in the ancient Near East from this time period. It was as common maybe as surrogacy is today, and it comes also with complications. And so really this story is not how to solve a problem and make it better. That was their goal, but it becomes how to make a bad situation worse. Any experience in that? Well, in case you haven't, here are four keys on how to do it that we learn from this story. First, move ahead without consulting God. Yep, that's what Sarah did first. Then Abraham followed suit and went along with Sarai's proposed solution. You might wonder, why would he do that? Because he was feeling pressure from Sarai? Probably. It's likely that he also was feeling the pressure of childlessness. We know that he really was from the previous chapter. So personally and culturally, he too was open to considering and acting on his options. Notice any parallels here to the Eve and Adam story in Genesis 3? There are some. Well, so how to make a bad situation? Move ahead without consulting God. A second way to do this is to bend or ignore God's rules. You know, and also especially justify your actions by blaming God for his action or inaction. I mean, what other option do I have? Look to the world for alternate solutions. Do whatever works to get the results that you want as quickly as possible. I mean, after all, did their solution work? Hey, it seems to have. I mean, he slept with Hagar, and it says, and she conceived. Look at that. After all, God had nothing to show for, you know, all of the 10 years that they had given him to act, and they were able to get almost instant results when they put their plan into effect. Results they all felt good about, initially, I think. But in time, things started going off the rails and taking them off the rails because that's always what happens when we're not in sync, with God's way and God's goal for us. In this case, when Hagar knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. Halal, the word in Hebrew, means make light or insignificant, belittle, show contempt, and can even be despise. So instead of simply relishing her own rise in significance, she belittled, put down, despised Sarai. And it's easy, I think, to see why. I mean, you've been a slave all your life, second class or lower, and suddenly you're getting a taste of what it feels like to be first class. You ever traveled in first class? No, I haven't either. But I've heard people that do, and apparently it's quite the feeling there. So she was getting a taste of that. But God, in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3, had actually promised to curse anyone who kalals, belittles, despises Abraham. So if you know your biblical story, you're thinking, this isn't really a good move, Hagar. And Sarai, well, she had hoped for a rise in her fortune. But what is actually happening is that she is put down, not built up and elevated. And Abe, well, he was hoping things would improve too. And when things got from bad to worse, the third thing that they do to make a bad situation worse is they try to pin the blame on others. The blame game. Now, you've probably guessed that this was coming next. I could, because that's where my natural instincts go as well. It's always easier to criticize the faults and failures of others and overlook, or at least minimize, our own. Sarai blames Abraham. You are responsible for the wrong I am suffering. Is Sarai right? Who thinks she's right? Nobody? I thought she's kind of right and kind of wrong. You know, it's yes, but not the whole truth. That's the way this works, right? And Sarai demands that Abraham solve the problem he caused. It should have been we, but, you know, he is much easier at that time. And Abraham, he tries to wipe his hands of the whole thing by putting the problem back in Sarah's lap. Your slave, not ours, your slave is in your hands. Do with her whatever you think is best. Just so you know, doing whatever you think is best, it's also a bad move. Not whatever we think is best. Not, let's ask God to help us find a way out of this mess. But rather, whatever you think is best. I was reminded of an Albert Einstein quote. Albert Einstein said, "We cannot solve our problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them." Yeah. But that doesn't keep Abraham or Sarai or us from trying. Abraham's passive, "not my problem" approach, Sarah's abusive treatment of Hagar, taking her anger and frustration out on her. Higher thinking is definitely needed. But before we get to that, there's still a fourth way to make a problem even worse. And that is justify your own bad behavior. Implicitly, each of these characters must have justified their behavior because they're blaming the others. After all, what else could I do? What else could I do? And I'm sure the third one said, and what else could I do? All or any of them could easily have actually done something different, but they didn't and don't until God does. See, they will do something different, but only when God does something. So what can you do when you're at the end of your rope? You know, you may be tempted to try and wipe the slate clean, clear the deck, get a new friend or a spouse or family or job or church or kids. I remember hearing a story of some parents of three rather unruly teenagers, and they were asked, if you had the chance to do it all over again, would you? And they said, oh yes, we would have kids again, just not the same ones. Yeah, well, that's not really possible, but okay, whatever. You know, but the problem is we always take ourselves with us into the new situation, bringing the seeds of the old problem with us because they are within us until we face our part in the mess and messes that we helped cause. You know what? But there is hope because God is there to find us in the mess. He doesn't say, okay, as soon as you get out of that, come see me. The grace moment happens at Hagar's lowest moment. She is not only far from the place she has called home, she has only a vague idea of where she is going. We know direction-wise, she's heading back to Egypt. Okay? Like the Israelites, remember when they got into problems? Let's go back to Egypt. Notice her response to the angel's question in verse 8. Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? She only says, I'm running away from my mistress Sarai, she answered. She is hoping that wherever she is going, it will be better than what she is leaving, doesn't she? We always do. But will it be better? Only God knows. Well, if we take our old self to the new place with us, our old attitudes and actions, is it going to be better? Probably not. Which is why we desperately need God's help and grace. And thankfully, God never gives up on you. And if you want to know more about that, you really should be coming to the Thursday study that meets at our church that Pastor Terry Hibbert is leading on that. By itself, verse 9 in this chapter, I'll just read that. Then the angel of the Lord told her, go back to your mistress and submit to her. Wow. By itself, that doesn't sound very gracious, does it? It sounds hard, very hard. It may even sound abusive. That is, go back and take a beating. But I don't think that's what it says. And I don't think Hagar could have done what she did if that was the message to her. I think he is saying, Hagar, there is no future going back to Egypt. Egypt in biblical history is not a place you return to. Hagar somehow, we don't know the story, somehow she had escaped from Egypt and found herself in the family of Israel's ancestors. And no matter how grim things get there, it is a better place to be because that is where God is and the promises of God and God's purpose for the world. Egypt is the place where Israelites will be mistreated and from where God will have to rescue them. And Hagar is challenged to take a similar view, even though in this case it will be ironically putting up with ill treatment from the people of God themselves. But God will work on them too. Hagar, the angel says. If you actually look at the story, the narrator calls her Hagar, but none of the other characters ever call her. They call her maid, servant, slave. God calls her personally by name. He's the only one that uses her personal name. Hagar, you need to face the pain, the problem, rather than run from it. Leave behind the mindset and attitude that got you into this mess, and I will help you get through it. That, I think, is the message. And so the angel of the Lord, that is an angel representing and speaking for God, gives her some incredible promises to encourage her, to strengthen her, and to sustain her. And you know what? God always does. And so what can we do when you're at the end of your rope? Face the future with God's help and promises. Face the pain, the uncertainty. The verse 10 promise, you know, that I will increase your descendants. He says this to Hagar, so much that they will be too numerous to count. Does that sound vaguely familiar, like any other promise? It's the promise God gave to Abraham, right? Now you do this, and you are going to benefit from that great sky-high promise as well. And God names her child. I wonder if he isn't adopting him in that, because that's what happened when you named a child. That was like an ownership of that, taking them to be your own. And the name he gives them has great meaning and significance. Ishmael means God hears. God hears. You shall name him God hears, for the Lord has heard of your misery. And I wonder if he isn't saying, in the moments and days when you feel like no one cares if you even exist, and those days will come, just call for your son. God hears, and remember my promise. Remember this moment. Well, then what are we to make of verse 12? He will be a wild donkey of a man. I don't know. That doesn't sound very positive, does it? You know? Yet culturally speaking, a wild donkey was one who was free and at home in the world. I was trying to think of modern equivalents. Maybe, you know, he'll be a redneck. He'll be a free spirit. And each of those can actually also have double meaning, can't they? They can be used as a derogatory term, or they can be seen as something positive. And there's this same double meaning at work here in this verse. And so one can see in this description of Ishmael the lifestyle of the Bedouin, those people that lived on the outskirts of the town, kind of like gypsies somewhat, but they were, you know, the Bedouin peoples who had the flocks and herds and never settled down, but loved that kind of free kind of lifestyle, free spirits, but also with a feisty and defiant attitude toward those city slickers, those city dwellers. And so that can, those opposites can, you know, be really conflicted, and it looks like that's probably what's going to happen, but opposites can also attract. And so Hagar's response to these words, what is key is that she hears them as being very positive. For she is willing in this, what do you do, is to trust and obey the God who sees and hears me. What I've heard, what I've experienced, I'm willing to bank on that, all in. God had not taken away from her her ill treatment. He has instead sent her back to face it. But he has promised to make it worthwhile. Just a note here. In the book of Samuel, for example, the famous King David, before he's ever king, he is also in mortal danger in a home, in the home of his master Saul. 1 Samuel 19. And just note, in that occasion, he needed to flee. His life was in danger. So just don't hear in this, oh, I'm in an abusive relationship. The Bible says I should just go back into it. No, you might need to also read the other one, and maybe what you need to do is to flee in that situation. So we need to be, each situation is unique and requires an appropriate response. But I think John Goldengay is right when he says, when you meet Hagar in heaven, I don't think she will be complaining about the angel's message. I don't think she'll be saying, no, that was a really a... She might be saying it was a hard message, but it was one that gave an opportunity for life and getting in on the promises of God. I think what Hagar is most amazed by, and notice what she focuses on, is that God saw and heard her. In other words, he personally came to find her. The God who sees me, and I have now seen the one who sees me. That speaks of a face-to-face personal encounter and meeting. And unsure of how to identify this God that she has never known because she's never experienced him like this, one who seeks and saves the lost in the mess, she settles on a name that describes how she experienced him. As the one who sees or the one who looks out for me. El Raui. This is what the God of Abraham and Sarai and now Hagar is like. The Lord didn't deliver Hagar from the trouble in her life, but he presented her with a pathway through it if she would trust and obey him. And it is evident from how this chapter ends that Hagar took God at his word, and that Abraham, notice, he gave her son that name. God hears, just like God said. And I'm sure that they all had a story to tell. Now, the closing invitation of verse 14, to stop at the well of the living one. The invitation there in this end of this chapter is basically next time you're traveling through, if you travel through this way on your way maybe on business to Egypt, stop, and you stop at the well of the living one. Think about what happened here. Maybe the God who saw and found Hagar will meet you there too. In fact, when we come to the New Testament, there's a story of Jesus meeting a woman at the well. It's a parallel to this story. And so the invitation to us, we can't all travel there, but we've traveled there in reading this story. And so look out for this God, because he is looking out for you. Not only when you are at your best, but even, maybe even especially when you are at your worst. What God calls you and I to do in that moment probably won't be easy, but it will be for our best. And he will give us the courage and strength to do what he says if we trust and obey him like Hagar did. So as the worship team comes up, I just want to pause. You can keep the image of the well there for a moment. There, thank you. I want you, just in some time of silence, to listen, think about, is God speaking to you in this story this morning? Maybe he's wanting you to experience him this morning. So as the worship team comes up, and then we'll have communion. So let's just spend some quiet time in prayer, listening prayer. Let's pray. Oh, gracious, sovereign Lord, we thank you that there are wonderful places, glorious ones in creation, and even in times of worship where we can experience you. But we thank you that you are not a God who is confined to the best places, but even to the worst. You show up when we're at the end of our rope. And we thank you that you are the God who sees us, who looks out for us personally, collectively. And you show us that we can trust in you. And I pray, Lord, that we, whatever we have heard from you speaking into our lives this morning, Lord, that we would trust and obey you and trust in your promises to us. Amen.